Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her back. And again, thank you so much for listening in. If you have some questions for her about your pet's health, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question, even a photo. Love to see your photos too, pet photos, on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And certainly love to hear from you. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Hey, it's nice to be here. This is my last official duty before I'm on vacation.
Yeah, off to Barbados.
I have a house full of pets. And it's just one of those things that when you get a pet, you have to stop and think about, you know, what are you going to do if you can't take care of it? And boy, I've got multiple people involved, including like coffee and breakfast for the morning pet sitter and lunch for the noon pet sitter, all in the ready in the refrigerator, and 3 pages of instructions. And I'm not that paranoid, so it's like it's going to be a lot of work, but it should be worth it. And you know, whenever you're traveling, always make sure that you've got backup. I actually called a former vet student of mine who owns a couple of clinics in Janesville, where I'm now living, and I begged him, said, please, can my pet sitters use your facility, even though, you know, and they were very willing to do that. But, you know, always make sure you're leaving emergency numbers and everything, because you never know when something's going to happen.
Absolutely. Well, a fair number of people are allergic to cats to some extent.
Yeah.
Ways to minimize the effects of that?
Get a kitten or a cat when you're a young child. That's the best way, the best way. There was a study that came out of Europe that was looking at, you know, age of people when they got pets. And if you got a cat when you were young, you get kind of desensitized to the mm-hmm. proteins that are in their saliva and on their skin and so on. But if you get one as an adult, you have a much higher chance of developing pet allergies. So if you are going to get a cat as an adult and you never were exposed to one, and this actually just came up this morning because I had a woman come in with 2 cats that she was getting kind of her final veterinary care because she's rehoming them this weekend because she lives in a small efficiency apartment, no way of isolating these cats from her bedroom. And she got them, her parents were both allergic, and they said, you can never get a cat until you move out. She moves out, gets her own place, gets 2 cats, and is allergic, and is now pretty severely allergic. So ideally, if you're going to get a cat as an adult, keep them out of the bedroom. That's also something that will significantly cut down on your risk. And then damp mopping the cats a couple of times a week, you know, and using a HEPA filter vacuum and so on is going to be really helpful. And, you know, trying not to have a place with carpets and stuff because that tends to hold a lot of the allergens.
Yeah.
But, so when your kid asks you for a cat, you know.
Actually, it might not be a bad idea to
let them be exposed. Yes.
Yep. Well, Dale in Milwaukee has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Dale.
Hello.
Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, my question is, I have a little black cat, female, and when she eats, she throws up right away. I suspect she has some kind of a bug.
Is she eating, like, her appetite's good, and
it's not very good, appetite.
Oh, okay. Well, vomiting is a clinical sign of a lot of different diseases. It may be something that's affecting the stomach, so things like a foreign body, a big trichobezoar, which is a hairball, but not like your classic ones that they can vomit. It may be inflammation in the stomach. We can even see cats vomiting for things like heartworm disease. That cats can get heartworm, but it causes a reaction in them rather than in dogs, where they get typically exercise intolerance. A lot of cats will start coughing or start vomiting. So pancreatitis, liver disease, cancer, infectious diseases typically are going to be young cats and not older cats, because most older cats have been either exposed or vaccinated for some of the things that can cause vomiting. So if it's, her appetite's poor and she has this as a problem, it's time to go in and have a good physical exam done. And depending on what they find on physical exam, getting some lab work done as well. And, you know, it's going to depend on the age of the cat, kind of what lab tests they look at as well. So time to go in and not put this off. I was hoping you were going to say that she has a great appetite. She's perfectly normal. And she just goes over to her food bowl and wolfs her food down and up it comes almost undigested. Many cats, I call that piggy cat syndrome, where they just are kind of binging and purging. And sometimes we can control that by spreading their food out on a cookie sheet or putting it in like a muffin pan in the little individual cups to make them slow down and eat each kibble and enjoy each bite rather than just swallowing it whole. I think your cat sounds a little different, though.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we can take some more calls here. Jane in Brookfield, let's turn to you next. Hi, Jane. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. I would like to know, we have an Airedale that's about 12 years old, and sometimes he's in pain when we take him for a walk or up the steps.
Mm-hmm.
Can I give him aspirin?
Aspirin is one of the drugs that's in the class called a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. And we have other ones that are out there that are prescription products that are safer for dog use that you could purchase or get from by prescription from your veterinarian. The reason why we don't tend to use or recommend aspirin is it has a much higher rate of causing gastric ulcers than any of the other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories that are labeled for dog use. Although those can do that, and we always recommend giving it with a meal, it's much less than with aspirin. So, in a pinch, if you needed to use something, make sure that your veterinarian is calculating out, looking at the weight of your dog, an appropriate dose for your dog. And if it's something that you need to be using on a fairly frequent basis, a 12-year-old dog could have underlying liver disease or worse, kidney disease. And if you're, continually giving this medication, it can worsen both those problems. So, or potentially actually cause them. So be really careful with just using an over-the-counter preparation. Even something like ibuprofen, which we take regularly, a lot of adults take it. That is the therapeutic dose for the dog is really close to the toxic dose. So, you got to be careful. I'd be recommending if your dog's that sore, in to see your veterinarian, get some pre-treatment lab work done and get your dog going on one of the drugs like Prevacox or Rimadyl or any of these other ones that are out there.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Don in West Salem next. Let me get you on here, Don. Hi, Don. No, are you there? Well, we lose.
We can go. I think we've got a question on guinea pigs.
Hold on a second. Oh. Well, let's see here. Let's try him over here. Don, are you there? Okay. Let's try Julia in Mondovi then. Julia, hello to you.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have Yorkie Terrier. He's 5.5 pounds. He's 3 years old. He's had like a ear crustation on the inside of both ears. It's actually caused no hair growth on the ears, how we usually have it clipped so that it's low hair there anyway. But now the hair doesn't grow there at all. But I took him into the vet. He's been on Clavamox 62.5 milligrams twice daily for 4 weeks. We're right to the last day now. It has been clearing it up. It's not totally gone. He's had a thyroid test, and that came clear. No problems there. And sometimes the ear flap, sometimes even little pieces of the ear, like at the tip or around the edge, will actually come off.
Yeah, yeah. There's a condition that is called ear margin seborrhea, and it's not uncommon in small breed dogs. Yorkies are probably not one of the more common ones, but we can see it in Yorkies, and we can also see it in a lot of Dachshunds and things will get it as well. And they tend to get like a lot of like thick kind of crusty buildup around the edges of the ears. Things that we would want to rule out before we, just assume that this is a seborrhea type problem, which is just a change in the turnover of the skin cells, is something like, especially if it's itchy, we will see dogs with scabies or, you know, mange mite. Actually, they like to live around the ear margin as well. And so doing some skin scrapings to make sure that there isn't a parasite there, especially in a dog that may be going to a grooming parlor where other dogs may be coming in. There's always a chance of picking up some of these things that are contagious between dogs. And as your veterinarian probably did, which is why they went to put your dog on Clavamox, is rule out if there's a secondary infection there. And so sometimes we'll see staph infections and so on the ear margin. And so if your veterinarian is finding bacteria on cytology and you treat it with an appropriate drug, and for a Yorkie, that sounds like a pretty appropriate dose. That would be about the dose of that antibiotic that we would use for a 10-pound dog. So sounds like it. If it's a, you know, regular size Yorkie, appropriate. Going back in for a recheck to see, is there still bacteria there? If there is, get it cultured. And so we see frequently now a lot of methicillin-resistant staph infections in dogs. And they're usually the staph bacteria that dogs get called staph intermedius. But it's real important to rule that out. I just had a dog in the other day that had a non-responsive bacterial infection in its nose fold and cultured it. And sure enough, we had to change to a much more potent antibiotic to try to get it under control. If there's no bacteria there and it's just this kind of crusty stuff, there are things that you can use, different anti-seborrheic shampoos and lotions and so on, that will help keep that crust to a minimum and help prevent the buildup that can then lead to infections. So I think it's time, even though it's not 100% cleared up, go back in and see, because it may just be the crusts that are there just from the normal skin turnover.
Good thing to do. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Sandra in Madison who says, a few weeks ago, I came across a strange object on my dining room floor, size of a penny, looked like a tiny slender shrimp with a fleshy pink mouth, end quotes on one end. Yeah, thought it might be a larva, so I took it to Phil Pelletieri. He said it was not a larva, that it was definitely animal tissue and might be a tumor. I have three cats. Could this tumor have dropped off one of them? Should I take them into the vet to see if they have more?
Yeah, well, it definitely could be. I had a dog in yesterday with a skin tag that was held on by just a thread of tissue, and it was just hanging there. And so, you know, I'm wondering if they're especially a long-haired cat, if it was on their belly or someplace where the owner doesn't normally touch. Did it, you know, just was it a skin tag that was just hanging by a thread that got pulled off, and you know, that's what it was. If I don't know if she, it was a few weeks ago, so I doubt she still has it. But I was going to say, take it into your veterinarian and let them have a look at it as well. And I think it's a good idea for any cat to make sure you go in 1 to 2 times a year for a good physical exam, especially older cats. Twice a year is recommended because they tend to have more health problems that can get out of control much faster. So if they haven't been in a while, go in for a complete physical. I think that'd be a good idea.
As part of the calorie conversation that we were having a little earlier, a caller in Arborvitae said that you shared a good website for comparing calories and other nutritional information of pet foods. Do you?
Yeah, there's two.
Bring that one up again?
Yeah, there's two that we'll use. And the one that I used to use, they've pulled down all of their information on the different calories, and it was called balanceit.com. And I assume they're just looking at, because manufacturers will change their formulations and so on, but if you go to Balance It and kind of follow that, hopefully they'll repost all of those. There's another one that I like to use for cats as well, and it's kind of a strange name. It's called Binky's Page. Binky was a cat with diabetes, and so the owner worked with veterinary nutritionists, and it's a wonderful page that many veterinarians go to on a regular basis that looks at not only the calorie content of both dry and canned cat foods, and definitely not all of them that are on the market, but many, many of them that are, but looking at the protein, the fat, and the carbohydrate level. And I think that's really important, because it really, you're not just looking at the calorie content, but you're looking at where those calories are coming from. And we always want to try to feed cats a higher protein diet than a lower protein diet. So those are both great sites to look for.
And a caller, someone who couldn't stay on the line, wonders about cleaning cats' ears. Should they be cleaned regularly?
It really depends on the cat. You know, I have two cats at home right now. They're both 9 and 10, and I have never cleaned their ears. Beyond if they've got a little bit of earwax that I can just visibly see and the ear, you know, isn't red, I'll sometimes just take a Kleenex and wipe it out. But if it's a significant amount of buildup, the cat's scratching its ears, the ears are red, anything like that, then definitely, you know, getting them evaluated and potentially treated if necessary, and then getting on a regular schedule for cleaning would be helpful.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest here. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question about your pet's health, I hope you'll join in today as we visit with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. You can reach us by phone at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page. Love to have you there. Post their photo. We've got, I see, Tom just set up photo of his.
Oh, a nice yellow lab.
So if you got a photo or a question, just go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and you can post it right there. John in Milwaukee has a question, though, for you, Sandy. So let's go there. Hi, John.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have an 11-year-old male exotic short hair cat. He's had trouble with skin issues and all that, so he's been treated with steroids. But lately, it seems like he's getting a bit of arthritis. Being a cat, you can't keep from hopping up on things. We tried lower beds and all that, but what can we do to help him out a little bit? It's only when he first starts up in the morning.
Yeah, and that's very typical. And how observant of you. Most people don't recognize that their cat has a problem until you start seeing issues like they don't want to go down the stairs to use the litter box, and because the carpet's nice and supportive and absorbent, let's just go on the carpet rather than, you know, go down to the basement to use the litter box. So changing your household around, doing some things like easy access litter box to the litter box, make sure that it's, you know, you've got one on every floor, kind of low entrance, and I'll have people just take plastic storage bins and cut it, you know, cut a hole out of the front. If you just Google, you know, images of homemade litter boxes, you'll see lots of different ideas there that work very well for these cats. But some things that you may want to look into, if your cat does not have to be on any special diet, there is a diet that's relatively new on the market by the Hill's Company called JD. It's a joint diet that's very high in antioxidants and fatty acids and so on. And we've had great success with it in dogs. And I'm hoping to see the same with cats. I haven't had a lot of experience with it, but you can talk to your veterinarian about trying a sample of that.
Unfortunately, he's on a special diet because he had the oxalic stones.
Oh, so you can't do that. Okay.
Nope.
So then I'd be looking at using some kind of other joint supplements. And this would be rather than using it in diet form, talk to your veterinarian about a dose of glucosamine. There's one called Cozaquin for cats, and you can even buy it now at, you know, some of the big box stores. I was in Target the other day and saw that they had it there, and your veterinarian may have it in their clinic as well. For, you know, really painful cats, you can use pain medication, and typically we'll use one called buprenorphine. It's a sublingual drop that you can use under their tongue. The non-steroidal anti-inflammatories that are out there for dogs, unfortunately, cats don't tolerate them, and they need such minimal doses at such a you know, maybe every 72 hours or so, that we really worry about kidney disease and so on being worsened by them. So we typically don't use that. But even, you know, like adding a fatty acid supplement in too, if your cat will eat it, that would be, again, something your veterinarian could figure out a dose for your cat's particular weight. Yeah. And it may actually help with the skin as well, because it's kind of decreases some of the inflammatory reactions that are occurring in the body.
Good luck.
It's weird because he plays with the other kittens like crazy. He can't get them to slow down. It's just when he first gets up and he does that stretch, you can tell that he's real.
Yeah, and that starts. Hey, I can sympathize. Yeah. I'm the same way in the morning.
I was thinking the same thing. Yeah. Oh, thanks, John. Thank you very much for calling. Jeff in Washburn, we turn to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. We're having a lovely spring day here up in Shawamigan Bay.
Oh.
It's amazing. I wanted to revisit the cat allergy discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And one comment was, at the time when I had cats, I don't anymore, I used a liquid commercial product that you wipe the cat down with that diminished your sensitivity to the allergens in some way, neutralized them. I forget what it was called.
Well, they have these the products out. There's one called like Allergy Relief, and all they basically are coat conditioners. And so when I mentioned back previously damp mopping the cat, you could do probably the same thing if your cat's on a good nutritional diet and doesn't you're grooming them regularly and so they don't have a lot of dead hair and so on. Just damp mopping them with a damp rag is going to remove some of the proteins that the cat's depositing on its hair coat as well.
It seemed like it helped when I had cats. The thing I wanted to ask you about is my allergies were unusual from others' cat allergies in that I lived with female cats, but whenever we were introduced, had a male cat in the house, or I went to friends' houses where there were predominantly male cats, I would be significantly more allergic to male cats than female cats.
Hmm. Interesting.
Both in a living situation and just visiting. One neighbor had two male cats. I'd go there within 15 minutes. You know, I was scratching my eyes and, you know, my lungs, I would get sniffly and my lungs would start, you know, tightening. And yet I would live with a female cat.
Yeah, a couple of things, theories. One is sometimes male cats, you know, it depends on, every cat's different. They produce different levels of FeLD1. Young cats tend to be less allergenic than older cats. And there's even some breeds of cats that produce less of the allergen. There's a breed called the Siberian that is, you know, very low in production of this particular allergen. So many people that have allergies can, you know, live with these cats comfortably. So that's, you know, just one particular breed that's out there. So I wonder if these boy cats, either it's because it's a size thing, boy cats tend to be bigger, a hair coat length, or, you know, whether they're, you know, the amount of grooming that they do. There's all those variables that are there. And I don't really know exactly, but I would, you know, I bet it's either just the luck of the draw as to the, you know, amount of allergen that they make, their size or something. But so stick with girl cats if they seem to work with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks a lot for calling, Jeff. Appreciate it. Elizabeth in Green Bay, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I have an 11-year-old toy poodle who she was in a very bad condition in a puppy mill, and we became her owner about 8 years ago. And when we got her, she was very timid, very sweet, and that lasted for several years.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the time we've owned her, she's had a whole host of health issues, mainly revolving around her ears. The last few years, she's turned from very timid to really, really nippy. At first, it was just if you woke her up, she would growl or, you know, kind of freak out. And now it's gotten to the point where even if she's just sitting and she doesn't want to be moved and she sees it coming at her, she will growl. It's also become apparent to us over the last few weeks that she no longer hears.
Okay. That could be a big part of it. That may be a big part of it. I have a little quote that I use with my students when I'm talking about senior pet behavior problems. And it's that most behavior problems that we see in senior pets are just exaggerations of problems that have been there all along. Okay, so if she has been shy and has learned that if you make a little growl, the boogeyman will leave you alone, or, you know, she's jumpy and so on, like you said, and now that she's older, lost her sense of hearing, she's going to be startling more easily. And so sometimes it may be that just her sense of hearing has worsened this pre-existing behavior problem where she was maybe a little fearful of people approaching, that type of thing. So sounds like it's been maybe going on at low levels for a while and it's just got much worse now. I would definitely take her in and make sure that she doesn't have anything painful anywhere, that her ears aren't painful, that's not part of it, because definitely pain can accentuate a problem like this. And, you know, if it is something with, you know, you're dealing with a painful situation, you know, maybe a trial on some pain medication. In older dogs, one that we use frequently is called tramadol, or as we mentioned earlier, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. So get that looked into. But, you know, in the meantime, I'd be, you know, thinking about getting a behaviorist to come out to your house and actually have a look at her and help you evaluate her. But, you know, initially get that good physical exam done, maybe a little blood work, and see if that, you know, can't get to the bottom of it that way first.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And on to Brad in East Bristol. Hi, Brad.
Hey, good morning, Larry. Hey, quick question for the doctor. I'd like to know about a supplemental yogurt for a German Shorthair puppy.
Probably not necessary. I think the reason why a lot of people want to use yogurt is that it's recognized for us that, you know, we're getting the probiotics or getting or the beneficial bacteria, I should say, to help inoculate the gut and keep it healthy. Unfortunately, a lot of dogs are lactose intolerant. And so here you are giving them a human product made usually with cow's milk, and it could potentially be a problem. I think that if you have your dog on a well-balanced large breed dog food, you know, adding in an extra calcium supplement like the yogurt may actually throw that off balance. If you feel that your dog needs some type of a dietary supplement, especially if they've had GI parasites or something where we need to re-inoculate the gut with healthy bacteria, there are dog-specific products on the market. There's one called Fortiflora that the Nestle Purina company makes, and another one called Prostora that the Iams company makes. And they're daily use medications similar to what we would take if we were on an antibiotic and we wanted to keep our gut healthy. So be careful with the yogurt. I know a lot of breeders use it, but it's probably just, you know, not doing a whole lot for that little puppy.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And an email from Ellen in La Crosse. My 12-year-old dog is on steroids for presumed multiple myeloma, had weight loss, lethargy, very enlarged spleen, low HGB.
Hemoglobin.
Okay, that's what that is. Since starting steroids, he's off, of course, starved all the time. He used to eat two small meals of dog food a day. Now he wants to eat all the time. Any idea for nutritious low-cal foods to keep him happy and satisfied in his old declining state?
Oh, this is a sad type of cancer to have, because usually it invades the bones and it affects protein levels in the body and so on. And dogs, you know, they don't live with it that long. So I'm glad that your dog is comfortable with being on this particular medication. That is one of the side effects of the steroid, of using steroids, is increased appetite. And so I would recommend, you know, keeping your dog on its current diet and not upsetting its GI tract at all, but perhaps look into using things like baby carrots or, you know, green beans or peas or something like that, which are going to make your dog feel like they're full and they've got you know, something going in, but again, relatively low calorie. And you know, when we were dealing with a dog that's got a potentially, you know, terminal disease, I don't know if they've actually got a diagnosis yet. I'm a big believer in quality of life, and depending on the size of the dog, if they gain a few pounds, let them die happily.
Yeah, what's the difference?
Yep.
Dick at Eau Claire, on to you. Hi, Dick. Thank you for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
We have a black cat. I want to say it's up around 11, 12 years old. We feed it a science diet and some soft canned cat food. And it'll grit its teeth, not all the time, but maybe once or twice a day. It'll grit its teeth, and then it'll vomit.
Hmm. That's something that has twice a day vomiting has me concerned. And the grinding of the teeth is one of the things that we'll see when cats are displaying nausea. Some of them will drool, you know, but grinding teeth is one of the other things that we'll see. So that's telling me that your cat's feeling pretty nauseous and then obviously is displaying it by vomiting. Why? Well, we mentioned earlier all the different things, from primary gastrointestinal problems to things away from the stomach, like hyperthyroidism and kidney disease and so on. So time to go into your veterinarian, have your senior kitty looked at, be prepared that they're probably going to want to run some lab work on your kitty to be able to find some answers. And hopefully it's something that is manageable and we can get your cat feeling better quickly. And there are anti-nausea drugs that we can use for cats, but, you know, it's better if you can find the underlying cause and treat that. That would probably be best.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for calling, Dick. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Marty in Appleton, your turn next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry.
Morning.
Doctor, I have a question. My son and I are considering getting a dog. We're looking at a beagle. He's 10, by the way, my son.
Mm-hmm.
And outside of the general health concerns that you have for all dogs, are there anything specific that I need to know about as far as beagles go?
Well, there's a reason why beagles get used in laboratory, you know, labs for research a lot. It's because they're small. They're usually healthy. They don't have a whole lot of health problems. They're kind of, I hate to say it, but the lab rat of the dog world, you know. So they do tend to be a healthier breed of dog compared to other breeds. Their short hair coat and so on makes them, you know, easy to maintain. Your son's at a great age to be getting their first dog. But, you know, some of the things that we will see in the breed, epilepsy is one of the things. We do see epilepsy in beagles. And so this would be something that when you are looking for a breeder, be looking at past health history of other dogs in the line to make sure that we're not, you know, you're not adopting a dog that potentially has this in their background. There is a syndrome that beagles get where it's called beagle pain syndrome, which is a inflammatory disease of their nervous system. It's uncommon, but the fact that it actually has beagle in the name tells me that, yeah, we see it in this breed of dog. But again, it wouldn't be something that I would think you would talk to a breeder about and see very often. They do tend to have, probably the biggest problem I see with beagles is getting fat. They are the garbage disposal of the dog world. They have a nose that's not, you know, that just never quits, and they will pick up things outside, eat anything they can, steal food. And so if I, you know, had to say, are they overrepresented in the obesity, you know, line of dogs? Yes, definitely. Which is why when we start seeing breeds like the Puggle, which are pugs and beagles put together, you know, we've got that double issue with obesity because pugs also have that as a problem. So be really careful about feeding your dog and measured amounts of food and try to keep them lean to prevent some of the complications that can occur with obesity, which I do see in beagles, like knee problems and diabetes and different things like that.
I had a purebred Cocker Spaniel that was a medical nightmare.
Oh, yeah.
Everything from ear problems to thyroid to... You name it.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering if you know, in getting into a beagle, if I was going to deal with the same type of ear problems that I had with the Cockers.
Well, not so much. Cockers tend to have very proliferative glands in their ears, and so they produce more earwax and more oils and get... and that's, you know, one of the things that keeps their coat looking so nice as well. Beagles do have the floppy ears, and so there's a potential that they could get ear infections, but I don't think it's at any higher rate than any other breed of dog. But if, you know, when I see, you know, think of Cockers, I think eye problems, ear problems, skin problems,
oh,
you know, you name the organ, they got the problem. So, but it's, you know, those are, that's very common for Cocker Spaniels. I think you've made a really great choice for a family dog.
Thank you very much for calling, and good luck picking that dog. Terrence in Winona, Minnesota. Let's go to you next. Hi, Terrence.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. Thanks for calling.
I have a 12-year, 8-month-old German Shepherd, and just before Christmas, I noticed he has a growth on his anterior gum, and it's starting to encase his two front teeth on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Put him on antibiotics just to see if that might be an abscess situation that is not improved. It seems to be getting larger. It's difficult to take him into the vet because he's a very aggressive dog.
Mm-hmm.
And does not do well with anesthetic.
Ooh. Well, this is a problem that you may have to bite the bullet. And if you have a dog that you are concerned about, that you want to do kind of a one-stop shop for getting this thing biopsied, which will need to be done most likely under anesthesia. Typically, an older dog, we do worry about tumors. Whether it's malignant or benign is going to depend on what's found on examination, what's found on x-ray, if there's bone involvement, and biopsy as well. The majority of growths that we see in dogs that are just kind of pink and fleshy and they're not, you know, they're not bleeding or bothering the dog are benign, but they often originate from the ligament that holds the tooth in place. And so my own dog had a benign tumor similar to this that was encasing her canine tooth on the bottom of her jaw. And we debulked it twice. And the third time we ended up, I said, just go in. And so we had to remove the tooth and some of the bone that actually the ligament that attaches the tooth to was attached to. And so now she's, you know, got kind of an off, a little funny look with her tongue hanging out on one side. But, you know, if anesthesia is a problem, going to a specialty clinic where there may be an anesthesiologist on board, taking your past medical records with what drugs have been used so that they know, you know, what your dog had troubles with, so they can come up with the right cocktail for your dog to be able to have a look at it. So even though it's a tough thing to do, you know, I think it's time to go in. Because if, you know, if it is something benign, we want to get rid of it and make your dog comfortable. If it's malignant, you need to know now so that potentially it may be able to be operated on and buy your dog a lot of good time, maybe a little toothless, but, yeah, you know, they might be comfortable. Yeah.
I guess the question I've got is, at his age, is it worth the intervention or do we simply let nature take its course?
Oh, you know, that's a question I get frequently on a whole host of health issues. And my pat answer to that is age isn't a disease. I've seen healthy 12-year-old shepherds and, you know, and I've seen shepherds live to be 14, 15 plus years of age sometimes. That doesn't happen very often, but it does. So if your dog is generally healthy, doesn't have any underlying heart disease or kidney disease or any problems that way, the, you know, the workup for something like this could buy your dog some comfortable time. And the way I like to look at it is, you know, there's, you know, the old saying that for every year of a dog's life is equal to seven of ours. Well, that's not really true because dogs age very rapidly early on, kind of level out and then age again as they get older. You're looking at a big percentage of your dog's life. Even if they only live another year, that's like 8% more life expectancy, which if somebody told you, we're going to cut your life by 8% because we're not going to do a procedure, I think we'd all go and have that procedure done because that's a big chunk of our life.
Yeah,
so
big chunk.
Talk to your veterinarian.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest today, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question about your pet's health, I hope you'll join in as we visit with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Number 1-800-642-1234. If you want to post a photo of your pet or you have a question that you want to post, you can do that at our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We would love to see those photos and get the questions there as well. Just to mention, Patricia McConnell will be coming a week from today. And she has, of course, she'll be talking about animal behavior. So we'll deal with behavior questions at that point. And right now, we're dealing with your pet's health. So let's go to Rose in Fairchild. It is your turn. Hi, Rose.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have been walking my dog, and last week she had gotten a tick. And I know with this kind of weather, you know, they're going to be out. But I'm just kind of wondering, she is protected with the vaccine, but that would be running out in March. And I'm just wondering if I should have her revaccinated or if this is going to last until, she's due again.
Yeah, you brought up a couple of really good points. First of all, when we have weather over 40 degrees, deer ticks love it.
Right.
Ticks don't die off. They hibernate. And so as soon as we get the weather up a little bit, like it has been in like around here, ticks are out, which is one of the reasons why I am now recommending year-round tick control. The vaccine you're talking about is the Lyme vaccine. Lyme vaccine does not prevent tick bites. Lyme vaccine will help protect the dog from Lyme disease. It's not 100% effective.
Well, she had it twice already.
Yeah, and there are other tick-borne diseases as well, such as anaplasma and Ehrlichia. So you really need to be using a topical tick control agent. Okay. And there are several of them on the market right now. In fact, there's a fairly new one that just came out that I think in Wisconsin, where we live in Tick Central, it's probably going to be really helpful. The people that make Frontline, Marielle, have come out with a new improved product. They didn't want to call it Frontline Plus Plus, but it's basically Frontline with a tinge of another chemical in it called Amitraz that makes the tick control much more effective, much more rapid tick killing effect. And it goes by the name of CertiFect. And this would be something that you could get from your veterinarian. If you are in a heavy tick area where your dog has been diagnosed with Lyme disease and so on, that may be a product to talk to your veterinarian about. And keep your dog on it year round until we've got a good snow covering and weather consistently down, in the below 40 degrees, keep them on it. And who would think that January we're going to be hitting record highs? So people that stopped last month, they're going to be in trouble.
Yeah, then I was just kind of wondering, too, how soon would I know if she has any symptoms of these new diseases?
It usually takes 4 to 8 weeks before they start becoming symptomatic. And many times they don't even develop any symptoms of these. So when you take your dog in March for their physical and vaccination, that would be the time to ask your veterinarian to do a screening test. And typically we do this one that is called the 4DX test. It looks for the top three tick-borne diseases as well as heartworm, and it just requires a few drops of blood, and it gives us lots of information. So consider getting that done when you're in March.
And Rose, thank you very much for calling. Natalie in Wittenberg, we're turning to you now. Hi, Natalie.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 16-and-a-half-year-old, rather large male black and white tuxedo cat, a domestic short hair, and he has what's probably a bone cancer. So the vet right now is just saying we should make him comfortable and keep him happy, but we're having a hard time keeping weight on him. And I was wondering if you had any suggestions of things to feed him that would be high calorie. I've tried buying high calorie supplements and he just won't eat them.
Well, some of the canned formulations of food are going to be more palatable. And, when you start looking at the protein, fat and carbohydrate levels of some foods, you're going to find that there's less carbohydrates in canned, more protein and fat, which is going to benefit your cat by helping maintain their muscles and so on. So Fancy Feast or Evo or any of those brands, go out and buy a smorgasbord of different ones that are really tasty to see if your cat likes them. If your cat does have a poor appetite because they're uncomfortable or something, there are appetite stimulants that you can use as well. The one that we typically use for cats is called mirtazapine. And the nice thing about it only has to be used every 3 days. And it has a long-lasting effect, and it really does help many cats that have chronic diseases like kidney disease or, something that is making them not want to eat much. It kind of perks up their appetite a little bit. So I'm sorry that your cat has this, and I hope you've ruled out other things that can cause weight loss like hyperthyroidism and kidney disease and so on.
That's good.
And we've also done the different kinds of canned cat food. I was just wondering if there was anything in the line. He likes things that are fatty, like fat off meat, but I'm afraid to give him too much because I don't want to give him diarrhea or something.
Yeah, there are some dietary special foods that you can get that are therapeutic diets. There's one called AD that Hill's Company makes. It's a canned formulation. There's another one called Max Cal that the Iams or Eukanuba Company makes as well, that you could potentially get from your veterinarian, or you can even order them sometimes online with a prescription. And I know that there's several online pet food stores now that are carrying prescription diets, and your veterinarian just has to fax in a prescription for you, and you can give that a go too. We'll sometimes even in our kind of local area, I know some veterinarians carry certain lines and that we may not. I will write a prescription and have the owner call the vet, and they're usually very happy about dispensing a formulation that we may not have through their clinic. So You know, don't give up and say, just because my vet doesn't get it or have it, I can't get it.
Okay, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Susan in Bangor, Wisconsin, on to you. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, everybody's talking about their house cats. My problem is I've got barn cats. They're not friendly. They don't let us pet them, that sort of thing. And there's one guy who I call Smushy Face that he's got an eye that is just leaking, leaking, leaking. It looks like some sort of a respiratory problem. But even though they're barn cats, I really want to take care of them, and I just can't figure out how to get them to the vet.
Yeah, and you know, a couple things you could try. You're right. Most likely it is a respiratory type infection, because many of the respiratory bugs, like the feline herpes virus, does affect not only the respiratory system, but also the eyes. Sometimes we'll see even if they were infected as a young kitten and now they're older, that if he's had some scarring, plugging of his tear ducts and so on, it may just be that the normal tears are kind of running over. So if he's holding his eye open normally and it's just overflowing of tears and he's got a wet face on one side, then it may not even be anything that you need to treat. It's more cosmetic than anything. And you mentioned that his name was Smushy Face or Smushy Face?
Well, you know, Smushy Face. He's yeah. got an ear that's ripped, and so it goes backwards, and he's come home with scars across. He's a very tough guy.
Yeah. You know, and so I when you said that, I was like, I wonder if he's got like some Persian-y type in him, where the squash face, because those cats run into so much trouble with tearing, because the tear ducts, when you look at them anatomically, because their face is so flattened, they run down from the eyes and actually bend back on themselves and will often kink, which causes the tears to not be able to flow down the tear ducts into the nose properly like they normally would. You know, if he's symptomatic, and again, if you can't get near him, obviously it sounds like he's kind of a tough boy. If you're feeding them, there is a dietary supplement that you can get called lysine. It's available through veterinarians in veterinary formulations, like a powder and a gel and so on. The powder mixes really well with canned food, but you can also buy it at human health food stores in a tableted form. Okay. They can be crushed. We usually like to give cats about 250 milligrams twice a day. So if he is coming by for regular feedings, that's something that even the healthy cats that are in your group would be, you know, they're not going to have any problems with it. What lysine does is it helps inhibit the replication of the herpes virus in the body. So that's why people take it, because people get herpes. And so it may be something that would be helpful for him. So if you can't get him in, give that a try and see if it doesn't help.
Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Email from Don wondering, what is the latest age at which a female dog should be spayed?
Well, that's a good question. If you are spaying a dog that you want to prevent breast cancer, like, you know, you want to have it be non-existent, we'd want to have them spayed before they have a heat cycle. When they have a heat cycle is questionable. We usually say let's spay dogs 5-6 months of age, because some dogs will start having their heat cycles when they're 7-9 months of age. Some dogs wait until they're a year and a half. So, but if you are wanting to spay to, you know, prevent births, if it's like an older dog that was a breeding dog and you want to prevent uterine infections and ovarian problems, there's no age. I mean, you can do it at any point as long as the dog can handle anesthesia.
All right. Let's go to Mary in Appleton next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have been taking my vets to, I have an established relationship with my vet for many years. We recently got a new puppy who's now 6 months old and needs to be neutered. I got a quote from my current vet as to how much it is, and I'm pretty sure that I can get it done cheaper at another vet. Is it kind of ethical or right for me to shop around and get my puppy neutered someplace else, but then go back to my other vet?
Any veterinarian would be probably more than willing to discuss with you why their cost is different. There's no comparison between what's being offered. You need to ask questions like, Are they hospitalized? Does it include lab work before they're neutered? What type of anesthetic do they use? What kind of qualifications do they have for people monitoring the dog? Does it include like overnight stay? Does it include the cost of suture removal if there are sutures? Cost may be cheaper someplace else, but they may be doing it differently. They may not have the same, anesthetic safety and so on that would your veterinarian may use. So, don't just think, well, my veterinarian's, charging more, I'm going to go elsewhere. Find out for your dog's safety. If it's they're both the same and they're handling the dog exactly the same, I think any veterinarian, they want to do what's best for your pet. And if saving you some money is what it takes, then, save the money and use it then for future needs. If you, run into troubles with your pet, sounds like you really like your veterinarian, that they do a good job. I mean, I have absolutely no troubles. We have this happen all the time. People that want to go elsewhere for dentistries or, our vaccines are cheaper someplace else, and yet they still want to go back. Just make sure any medical records that you obtain from another clinic get put into your vet's files so that we always know exactly what happened at the other clinic, what they did for anesthetic and so on.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Interesting comment from listener Chris here. I want to second the comment that male cats are much more allergenic than female cats. I've been allergic all my life and have noticed this.
Yeah, and it's interesting. We know that some of the sex hormones, if we have an unspayed or unneutered cat, they will be more allergenic. But once they're spayed or neutered, it tends to decrease it, and it may, for males, just not decrease it as much, so that could be part of it as well. So we're going to see a big spike in female cat adoptions, I can tell.
Right. Our guest today, as we take a look at your pet's health, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, and she'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're like me, the animals that are part of your family are important to you. And of course, you want to keep them healthy and happy. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Glad to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk with us today for the next half hour to share information and timely advice. Whether you're a lifelong pet owner or maybe you're new to sharing your home with animals, Sandy's really ready to answer your questions about pet health. When you call us, and you can do that at 1-800-642-1234, you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And don't forget to check our Facebook page. You can go to the Larry Mueller Show for updates, for news and photos. Click like when you're there, and we'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this look at the news here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along, and thank you for listening in. Questions, give us a call at 800-642-1234 or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Sandy, we have someone call in wondering about lab coats. Apparently has a dog that is afraid of white coats.
Hey, that's why they call it white coat syndrome, And so if a doctor walks in and has a white coat on, sometimes our blood pressure goes up and we get a little nervous. And for a timid dog or cat, that could be a problem as well. What we do is we make notes in our record as to what would make the appointment go better. Like, always, have the owner present or work with the patient on the floor. Or I had one patient where I had to play ball with them for a while, and the owner would always bring a tennis ball in, and we would just allow 5 minutes of playing in the exam room with his tennis ball, and that calmed the dog down, and we were able to then work with the dog. So sometimes it's even something as simple as take off your lab coat. And that's why, I dress like I'm, everything I wear is washable. Yeah, we get asked to wear these lab coats. My preference would be never wear one, but we get asked to wear one to protect our clothes and to look professional, but that can be frightening to the dog.
On to Bob in Brookfield. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
thank you for taking my call. I have a couple question that is going to write on the back of a couple other earlier comments by your viewers.
Okay.
One was a gentleman who had a German Shepherd with a growth or a lesion on his dog's jaw.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is the lady who was asking about cost. We've got a Nikita Husky, and we just had her biopsied for the same growth on her jaw. And it came back, and it wasn't malignant, or it wasn't the I guess, the worst kind of cancer, but it's locally aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have to do something about it here shortly. But the estimate that the vet gave me is just so expensive that it's prohibited us from doing it now. And I was wondering if the university vet school would have any services available for something like that.
We get asked this question frequently. When the vet school was put together back in the late 70s, early 80s, our charter, in our charter, we are mandated by state law to not charge less than anybody in the local practice area. So we charge at or above what other places charge. So even though we are a teaching hospital and there are senior students involved with your patients, the patient's care, we are mandated by law to not undercut local practitioners. So I wish we could be, you know, kind of like a, you know, one of a beauty parlor school where you go and you can get a $3 haircut or whatever, but we're not like that. And so if you are looking for, you know, less expensive ways, it's going to be a matter of probably, you know, seeing if there is a humane society that has a veterinarian that maybe is able to help you. I know that even, you know, at the vet school, although funds are limited, we do have some funds called respond funds for people that are on fixed incomes that have a one-time emergency that needs to, you know, have some funding. We do have things like that available. But this is where getting a pet, you really have to be thinking. I know Larry was talking to me earlier about someone who is unemployed who wants to get a dog, and this is like the worst time because pets, unfortunately, in this day and age, are a luxury. And when, you know, problems happen, we need to be, you know, looking out for, you know, how we're going to cover it. And so, you know, I'm a big believer in pet insurance. I think that it's, you know, well worth it in the long run, especially as pets get older. It's better to get it when they're young before they have pre-existing conditions. But I'm sorry that it's out of your price range, but, you know, you're really stuck. It's mm-hmm. As they get older, things do become more expensive.
There you go. Thank you. Thank you very much for calling. Corey in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Corey.
Hi there. I'm calling because I have two cats. I have my own cat, and then I moved in with a roommate that also has a cat. And they have this sort of perceived competition of food now.
Mm-hmm.
And so both of them have gained weight in the past 5 or 6 months. And I'm just wondering if there's any way that, any method for feeding them to, you know, let them know that they're going to get to eat, but then it's going to go away and they don't get to graze all day.
Yeah. I like to have cats very early on in their life be on a meal feeding schedule, kind of like what we do with dogs, where most dogs are fed twice a day, doing the same with cats. People get cats and they think, well, we can just leave the food bowl down and they can just, you know, wander in and out. Well, that may be the way the cat likes it, but almost all cats that are fed that way end up getting overweight. And you found that little bit of competition with having the other cat around is triggering, you know, more food consumption and more frequent trips back to the food bowl. So the first thing I would do is just bite the bullet and say, we're going to start meal feeding you guys, and cut down on some of the competition by maybe feeding one on the kitchen counter and one on the floor, one in the bathroom or the laundry room and one in the kitchen, whatever. Keep them separated until they both finish their food. If they don't finish it, you can put it away and bring it out later. I did have one vet student that came up with a really ingenious way of allowing the cat that was just a grazer, that didn't have a weight problem, and a cat that had a significant weight problem that really had to be on a meal feeding measured amount of food schedule. What she did was went out and bought a translucent large storage bin and then went to the pet store and bought a small magnetized dog door that has that you install. She just installed it in the side of the box. And the skinny cat wore the little magnet on her collar, which as she would approach the box, it would unlock the little flappy door. The cat could go in, and that's where her food bowl was. And so the fat cat would be looking through and going, how do I get in here? But the door would never open for her. So yeah. Worked very well. And for under $40, she had a little, you know, private restaurant booth for her slender cat. You know, and it's interesting that you brought this up, because one of the things I wanted to talk about is there was a little bit of math done, and they just found that just 10 extra kibbles per day, 10 extra kibbles, which is why when you measure food, you don't want to make it heaping, is enough to cause a cat to gain 4 pounds of weight by the age of 10. That could be like 50% weight gain. If you look at the average weight of the cat is like 8 to 10 pounds, you know, and you add another 4 on top of that, that's pretty significant. So, you know, that's why it's important to, you know, really regulate. And yeah, they're going to bug you, but make sure that feeding your cat when you get up in the morning isn't the first thing you do. We don't want the cat to learn, feet touch the ground, I get fed. But rather link it to something else, like, you know, you're going to sit down and eat breakfast, and the cats are now separated. And so they may, you know, pace around, but they'll learn very quickly, you know, when food's going to come and not bug you the other times.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks for calling. And on to Karen in Sparta. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Good.
I have a miniature dachshund puppy. She was born in August, so she's, about 5 months now. Her ears, it seems like I'm cleaning them 2-3 times a week. How can I keep them cleaned better? I mean,
that's a typical amount of buildup in the ears to require that frequent of cleaning. I hope that you've had the ears checked to make sure that there isn't an underlying infection. The two things that come to mind are either ear mites, which will cause a lot of debris, and sometimes dogs are not even that itchy with them. They just get a lot of debris building up in their ears. The other thing would be a yeast infection. They both can look alike. They both have kind of a dark, crumbly discharge. And so taking your puppy to your veterinarian and say, what's going on with these ears? They can, and obviously don't clean them before you go in, because we need to have something there that we can look at. But going in, and they can, usually we can get a swab, spread it out on a slide, have a stain it, have a look under the microscope, or, you know, do a mite check, looking down in the ears to make sure that there isn't anything in there that could be causing some more irritation. Once in a while, we'll get foreign bodies and things in the ear that can keep triggering wax and infection and so on. And then treat with the appropriate thing. If you have to clean your dog's ears more than once a week, it's time to be seen by a veterinarian. And then when it comes to what to clean them with, we're usually looking at something that has a surfactant in it. And so we like to look for ingredients like DSS, which stands for dioctyl sodium sulfosuccinate, is one of them. Usually there's, some acidifying agents and so on in there as well. There's lots of different products that you can use in dogs, and your veterinarian probably has their own favorite product or one that they can recommend that you can get over the counter. The things not to use would be alcohol. That can burn an infected ear. I wouldn't be putting vinegar in your dog's ear. Again, that's, you know, if you've ever made a vinegar and oil salad mix, you know, they float. It floats, you know, the oil floats on top. So you're not going to dissolve the wax in the ears. And also don't use any of the human ear cleaners that have carbamate peroxide in it. It foams. And for us, we're always told, you know, rinse it out. But because our ear canals go straight in, it's really easy to rinse water in our ear and get it out, because dogs have a J-shaped ear canal that kind of makes a sharp bend. Some of that stuff can accumulate down in the bottom and actually burn the lining of the ear canal. Mm. So avoid human ear cleaners.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. We had a Facebook question from Cheryl. We have a cruciate ligament repair scheduled for my 80-pound bull mastiff bloodhound mix. My palm chihuahua mix has had both knees done as well. How common is this, and what breeds are more prone to developing this problem?
Well, I'm wondering if the palm chihuahua mix, being a small breed dog, had a different problem. There's lots of different knee surgeries that can be done. Large breed dogs, definitely. We do see ruptured anterior cruciates. It's typically dogs that, like Labrador retrievers, golden retrievers, often carrying a little extra weight. There's some work being done at the veterinary school looking at genetics behind this and just seeing if there is some type of genetic predisposition to the anatomy of the knee that's predisposing them to it. Best thing you can do to try to prevent it is keep your large breed dogs slender rather than allowing them to get overweight. For little dogs, probably the more common knee problems we'll see are loose kneecaps or luxating patellas, which can result in ligament damage. But often if they're lame with that, they need surgical repair as well. It's uncommon to just see a ruptured anterior cruciate in a small breed dog. The cruciate injury may occur secondary to a problem with the kneecap.
Anita in Viroqua, your turn. Hi, Anita.
Hi, thank you. I had a question. I have a 3-year-old female German Shepherd Husky mix, and she lets me brush her teeth, but she has so much calculus buildup. Is it safe for me to give her those rawhides? And if it is, is it safe for her digestive system, and how often should I give it to her?
Well, there was a study done a few years ago looking at the use of rawhide for controlling dental tartar. I would recommend that your dog, if she's got significant tartar buildup, probably needs to have a dental prophy done to get her teeth clean, and then you can start with using something like rawhide to help keep it under control. But what the study showed is that it took to control a significant amount of the tartar in the mouth about 4 rawhide strips a day. And so that's a lot. And so here's kind of my rules on rawhide. Number one, it needs to be made in the United States. There are imported rawhides that we see a lot of problems with different chemicals and things that are used in some of the processing that can be problematic for dogs. So get U.S.-made rawhide. I was in my local grocery store the other day, and there was rawhide there, and it said U.S. rawhide. It had an American flag on it. You flipped it over, and it said made in Argentina. So you want to make sure that it is made in the United States. Number two, make sure you're using something like rawhide chips rather than the big knotted bones. The compressed rawhide and the knotted bones are hard enough that when a dog is a real eager chewer, they can break their teeth on it. So be careful with using some of the compressed rawhide. My own dog, it was a victim of the compressed rawhide and actually fractured both of her upper fourth premolars, which are the major chewing teeth in her mouth, and had to have them both removed. The other thing would be to make sure that your dog is not overweight. Rawhide is extremely high in calories, and so you're going to be adding a significant calorie load to your dog's daily intake if you're using rawhide daily. So they can't be overweight. And remember, it is food, and it's good food. And so if you have a dog that's protective of it, can't use it because they are going to be growling. If you have to get it away from them, if it's a small piece that they could potentially choke on. Watch your dog to make sure that they don't get diarrhea or have gas with it or have any issues. And be careful if you have anyone in the family that's immunocompromised, young children, elderly people, anything that's been on the outside of the animal can be in the rawhide. And so we can see things like salmonella and E. coli be transmitted through rawhide. And so we tend to treat it as a toy, but it really isn't. It's a piece of animal that's laying on your carpet all slimy. And if your kid's climbing over there, they could get into trouble. And I can remember my daughter when she was little climbing across the floor and meeting me with a piece of rawhide in her mouth. And that was when she was a toddler. And she's 19 now, so obviously survived the episode. But you got to be really careful with it.
Thanks, Anita, for calling. Teresa in Muskego, on to you now. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a 9-year-old, 4-month boxer female. She was spayed the whole thing from birth on. She was a healthy dog. Now she's throwing up every time she eats, and then she'll stop. And then we had her on dry food. We put her on wet food because the dry food seemed like it made her throw up more. We took her to the vet. They did an ultrasound. They checked her over, blood work normal, ultrasound normal, and she continues to do that. Now she's less anxious to eat. I don't know if it's just that she's getting old. My husband's afraid to get her checked out to the point where she would be anesthetized because we had a dog that wasn't normal once it came back and it was in the elderly ages.
Well, if she's not able to keep food down, she's probably not going to live very long. And so things that I get worried about, if the ultrasound was normal, that's looking at all the internal organs and the intestinal tract, but you can only tell so much from there. Sometimes you can see a pattern that's indicative of obstruction. You may see a tumor, that type of thing. But I think you're looking at jumping to the next level. And the next level would either be to do contrast studies where she would swallow some barium and you would look and make sure that it is going down, that she doesn't have something that's maybe obstructing her esophagus and the food just can't even get into her stomach, which would mean that she's actually regurgitating and not actually vomiting. There's a difference between the two. Vomiting is actually expelling contents from the stomach where she'll probably act nauseous and, like, you know, really start heaving and so on. Everybody knows what vomiting looks like. Regurgitation is she just stands up and opens her mouth and blah, up it comes. And usually occurs fairly quickly after eating as well. So, you know, contrast study may help rule out motility disorders or some type of obstruction that was missed by ultrasound. That can be done awake. The other procedure would be to scope her and actually have a look down her esophagus and into her stomach, getting biopsies and so on if necessary, depending on what they find. And obviously that would require anesthesia. So I think there's things that you can do, one requiring anesthesia, one not. And it just depends on the level that your veterinarian is able to get involved with. If they can do ultrasonography, I would assume that they probably are able to do a barium study as well.
There you go. Thank you, Teresa. Beth in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have an 11-month-old purebred Farrow Hound puppy, and she has had chronic diarrhea for about 3 months now. She's been to the vet to be tested for Giardia and parasites, worms, things like that. They've all come back negative. She's on a special, the IAMS diet that's low residue, and I think it's chicken-based. And we're not giving her any other treats or any other source of food. And still her diarrhea comes back every time she gets off the metronidazole medication.
Okay. Well, what metronidazole is it's a drug that does multiple things. It is an anti-inflammatory, and it also helps. It's an anti-protozoal drug, which helps but is not very effective against Giardia. And it also is an antibacterial drug, too. So it's got multiple properties. Long-term metronidazole, I've had some dogs develop some toxicity with it, so I'm always a little nervous about using it long-term. Not sure if your veterinarian just went through a therapeutic deworming program, but that would be one of the things that we want to be looking at is, you know, did they just say, okay, even though the stool sample was negative, we know that Giardia is one of these elusive things that we may not get a positive test back for. Let's just deworm her for it. And our usual treatment is using a drug called fenbendazole, and we treat for usually 5 to 7 days with that, usually along with some metronidazole to see if we can get it cleared up. You didn't mention if your veterinarian has quizzed you enough to find out what type of diarrhea your dog has. I know this is a wonderful lunchtime conversation, but we like to look at, is it small bowel diarrhea or is it large bowel diarrhea, meaning in the colon? Large bowel diarrhea is usually accompanied by straining, mucus, small volumes, frank blood. That's typical. Small bowel diarrhea is usually larger volumes or maybe some weight loss with it. There's no mucus or anything. And sometimes we'll even see a combination of the two things. But that kind of helps us with, you know, which diagnostic path to go down. It's possible that if your dog is responding to metronidazole, like I said, it could be Giardia. It could be that your dog has some gastrointestinal inflammation. And if that's the case, then, you know, maybe trying your dog on a hypoallergenic diet to see if it does have a food allergy rather than just going with a low residue diet, because we do sometimes see food allergies even in young dogs like this. And so that would be, again, something you would get from your veterinarian. Lastly, if it's a persistent problem, jumping in and getting, especially if it's small bowel diarrhea, getting a GI panel done where we're looking at Does your dog have the ability to produce the right levels of pancreatic enzymes? Do you have any bacterial overgrowth? Do you have cobalamin deficiency? So it's a blood test that we do. I know it's weird to do a blood test for GI function, but that you go in with a your dog fasted for 12 hours and send in a blood sample. It goes down to Texas. So hopefully we can get to the bottom of this, and hopefully next month you'll have some answers for us.
And thanks for calling. And Virginia, quick comment from you in Janesville.
Hi, I want to speak to the medical problems of poor people. You know, I heard your answer was get insurance and that sort of thing, but you have to realize there is a big recession going on, and people who worked all their lives don't have jobs now. The elderly person that's been productive is reduced to like an $800 a month budget, and all these animals at the Humane Society that no one wants. So I had an idea, and I'd like to hear what you think about it. About 3 years ago, the National Veterinary Association got a law passed, a federal law, that excused the student loans of veterinarians that agreed to work in rural areas. And it didn't even have to be for poor farmers. It was for farm animals. And I would very much like to see the professional associations work to excuse the student loans, which can be as high as $100,000, of veterinarians. Yeah.
Well, that, you know what? We've got to
yeah,
break in.
Yeah, that's a great idea, and it, not only would it help vet students, but it would also help you if that's, you know, if they can practice without the added expense of having student loans to pay. And I'm very sorry. It's a problem for everyone.
It is a problem for everyone. I'm sorry we don't have more time to talk about it. Virginia, thank you for calling. And Sandy, thank you so much.
You're welcome. I'll see you next month, hopefully with a little more tan than I have now.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, we'll be back the second Tuesday of next month, and we'll talk to her again. Thanks for listening. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.